on businesses, on small businesses. Well, and he will be good for black businesses. Well, how so? He's been in office for 4 years. And what we know is of the millions of dollars of contracts that the state of Georgia gives out, black voters, black people who make more than 28%, almost 30% of the population in Georgia have received less than 1% of the business contracts for the state of Georgia. Here's a person that says, Brian Kemp is saying that, yes, he cares about the people of Georgia and he is good for Georgia. Well, how so? Since he has been in office, 6 hospitals have closed, and we're on the verge of another hospital closing in Metro Atlanta. All of that is, yes, can we place that in his lap? Absolutely, because he has refused to expand Medicaid, which is part of the reason why even the latest hospital said that it is closing, because it cannot handle the weight of so many uninsured patients that are coming in. And so if he expanded Medicaid, will it actually bring in more than $1 billion in our state that we could have saved those hospitals? We could save this hospital that is on the verge of closing. But he doesn't care about that because he doesn't care about the people of Georgia. What he cares about is his own power. He has been voter suppressor.
We have 5 seconds. Well, we're going to have to leave it there. Latasha Brown, co-founder of Black Voters Matter, speaking to us from Atlanta, Georgia. Oh, and tune in on November 8th for our 3-hour midterm election night special. We'll be broadcasting live starting at 9 p.m. Eastern. That does it for our show. I'm Amy Goodman. Stay safe.
This is KBOO Portland.
And now, your daily volunteer-produced community newscast, the KBOO Evening News.
Coming up on the KBOO Evening News, Portland plans to mediate a lawsuit that challenges sidewalk camping under the ADA.
Biden will go after so-called junk fees from banks and airlines.
And in international news, the State of the Climate Report highlights improvements in solar and wind technology.
Good evening. This is the KBOO Evening News for Wednesday, October 26th, 2022. I'm Josh Salem.
And I'm Michelle Coppola. The Portland City Attorney's Office will attempt to resolve last month's lawsuit from 10 Portlanders with disabilities out of court. That's according to court documents filed Tuesday morning. In September, this group of Portlanders, through their lawyer, John DiLorenzo, sued the City of Portland for violating the Americans with Disabilities Act by allowing tents to block city sidewalks. The city has requested an 85-day extension before it has to respond to that lawsuit so the parties can continue mediation. This is the first glimpse into how Portland will approach this lawsuit. Similar lawsuits using the Americans with Disabilities Act to displace homeless residents have been successful in California. The extension indicates that the city thinks there's enough merit to the lawsuit that they want to avoid going to trial, looking instead for an out-of-court settlement. The remedy proposed by the lawsuit is to ban camping on public sidewalks, but to build mass shelters if necessary. That's because a Ninth Circuit Court of Appeals decision prohibits cities from criminalizing homelessness if there's not enough shelter beds for people. Mediation between the city and the lawyers for the plaintiffs is expected to start after Election Day.
President Biden announced plans to reduce the burden of so-called junk fees on consumers. It's part of a push to alleviate the financial stress that many Americans are feeling with the inflation rate above 8%. The Consumer Financial Protection Bureau will prohibit banks from charging overdraft fees when the bank website or ATM says there's enough money in the account. Overdraft fees are extra money that someone owes the bank if they draw more money from their account than they have. It would also make it illegal for banks to charge a check bouncing fee to someone trying to cash a check that then bounces. In his remarks, Biden said, quote, "Each year, these junk fees that companies charge cost Americans tens of billions of dollars, weighing down family budgets and making it harder for people to pay the bills, so my administration has taken action to eliminate these," end quote. Biden also highlighted other new rules for airline and travel websites to disclose hidden fees, like for picking a seat, checking a bag, and other add-ons. His administration also plans to tackle junk fees in other industries, like hotel bookings and termination fees from cable and internet companies. Estimates say eliminating overdraft fees and check bouncing fees would save consumers more than $1 billion a year.
President Biden is also now warning Russia not to use nuclear weapons, and the DOJ indicts Chinese intelligence officers. With more on the story, it's Alex Gonzalez with 2022 Talks.
Welcome to 2022 Talks, where we're following our democracy in historic times.
Russia would be making an incredibly serious mistake if we're to use a tactical nuclear weapon. I'm not guaranteeing you that it's a false flag operation yet. Don't know.
On Tuesday, President Joe Biden warned Russia to not use a tactical nuclear weapon in its war with Ukraine after Russia notified the U.S. it will start to stage routine nuclear drills. While Russia did comply with the terms of the last U.S.-Russia arms control agreement in alerting the U.S., it has raised concern as the conflict in Ukraine intensifies. Defense Department spokesperson Brigadier General Pat Ryder says they are monitoring the situation closely.
We have not seen at this time, though, any indication that Russia has made a decision or intends to employ nuclear weapons or a dirty bomb. But again, it's something that we'll continue to watch closely.
After criticism from Democratic and Ukrainian leaders, the Congressional Progressive Caucus has retracted a letter which called for President Biden to directly participate in diplomatic negotiations with Russia to bring an end to the war with Ukraine. The letter, originally drafted in June, was not released until Monday. U.S. Attorney General Merrick Garland announced the indictment of several Chinese intelligence officers accused of attempting to obstruct a criminal probe and pay bribes for access to classified information regarding the criminal prosecution of Chinese telecommunications giant Huawei.
This was an egregious attempt by PRC intelligence officers to shield a PRC-based company from accountability and to undermine the integrity of our judicial system.
The Chinese telecom company was facing federal prosecution in Brooklyn, New York for possible interference and meddling in U.S. politics and for trying to steal intellectual property. Despite lawsuits, recounts, and denials of the outcome in many battleground states, election law attorney Benjamin Ginsburg told an audience at the American Enterprise Institute Tuesday the 2020 election was a well-run election.
What's going to happen in 2022 sort of continues to fall under that general ambit.
Ginsburg stressed each state has pre-election day procedures set in place to make sure votes are being accurately counted at polling locations. In a debate with his Democratic opponent Tom Sherman, New Hampshire's Republican Governor Chris Sununu affirmed the 2020 election was not stolen despite having endorsed Republican candidates who claimed it was.
The citizens of New Hampshire have higher confidence in their system than pretty much anywhere else in the country. We do it right. We're the model for most of these other states.
And finally, officials said about 575 incorrect ballots for the midterms were mailed in Washington, D.C. According to the D.C. Board of Elections, the mistake was caused by a mismatch of residents to their newly updated electoral districts. The city will be mailing new ballots to each affected voter. I'm Alex Gonzalez for Pacifica Network and Public News Service. Find our HRUS indicators to support transparency and accuracy at publicnewsservice.org.
The race in Oregon's 5th congressional district between Democrat Jamie McLeod Skinner and Republican Lori Chavez de Remer is now considered to be leaning Republican. University of Virginia Center for Politics changed its rating from a toss-up. Back in June, the university had rated the race as leans Democratic. While McLeod Skinner raised and spent twice as much as Chavez de Remer during the summer, Chavez de Remer outgained her significantly through outside money. A Republican Party super PAC, the Congressional Leadership Fund, has spent $5.38 million on the race. The other two congressional races without incumbents, Southwest Oregon's 4th District and the newly created Willamette Valley 6th, are both rated as leaning Democratic.
For those who want to save the planet, the State of Climate Action 2022 report is recommending that you do these two things. One, that you eat less meat, and two, take public transportation. The report also says the rate of deforestation must decrease sharply, as should the use of coal. It also says heavy industries like steel and cement need to significantly clean up their emissions. The report examined global progress on 40 key indicators that are key to having global greenhouse gas emissions by 2030. Over half the indicators are well off track, with five heading in the wrong direction. The indicators of most concern were the use of gas, steel making, use of passenger cars, the rate of loss of mangrove forests, and emissions from agriculture. Bill Hare is the chief executive of Climate Analytics, one of the producers of that report. Hare said, quote, "What's particularly worrying is the rise in fossil gas-powered generation despite the availability of low-cost and healthier alternatives," end quote. But the report also found some bright spots. Solar power generation increased by nearly half between 2019 and 2021, while electric vehicles accounted for nearly 1 in 10 passenger cars sold in 2021. That's double the number the year before.
A new estimate says the economic benefits of wind and solar in rural Appalachia could top $65 billion. Renewable energy projects would generate local tax revenues, land lease payments, and wages. Dr. Anthony Leisowitz has more on this story with Climate Connections.
I'm Dr. Anthony Leisowitz, and this is Climate Connections. Appalachia has long been coal country. But as the U.S. transitions to other sources of energy, coal production in the region has fallen by more than half. Many coal towns are facing an economic downturn. But a recent report shows that rural communities in Appalachia could benefit the most from wind and solar development.
It's the ideal space for these economic benefits to really liven these communities again.
Gabriela Tosado is with the research nonprofit RMI. Her group analyzed how rural communities in various regions could benefit if the U.S. triples its solar and wind energy capacity by 2030. The group looked at expected local tax revenues, land lease payments, and employee wages generated by new solar and wind projects over time.
And altogether, the lifetime impact of the potential in Appalachia is about $65 billion in direct economic benefits.
Beyond that, local bars, stores, and manufacturers could see a boost. Tosado says getting there will take policy support for wind and solar and worker training.
So there is a lot of industry that needs to be built to receive these benefits, but it has just this waterfall effect for rural communities.
Climate Connections is produced by the Yale Center for Environmental Communication. To hear more stories like this, visit climateconnections.org.
The Western Joshua Tree is threatened by fire, development, and climate change. Now, conservation groups are pressing the California Fish and Game Commission to add it to the state's endangered species list. But that runs counter to the wishes of business groups. Suzanne Potter has the latest.
Pressure is mounting on the California Fish and Game Commission as it tries to decide whether to list the Western Joshua Tree as an endangered species. Climate change is harming a type of moth that the trees need for pollination. Entire Joshua Tree forests have turned brown due to drought. And Kelly Herbinson with the Mojave Desert Land Trust says fire has claimed more than 1 million trees.
What we are seeing right now is unprecedented. This is serious. These trees are not going to be able to adapt quickly enough to how significantly the changes are happening.
At a commission meeting in June, local politicians, the water board, building developers, and labor unions all argued that there are millions of Western Joshua trees left, and listing it as an endangered species would hurt development and jobs. Scientists, local residents, conservation groups, and tribal groups argue that Joshua trees are disappearing and must be protected. The commission recently put off a vote on the issue and will now take it up at its next meeting in February. Brendan Cummings, conservation director at the Center for Biological Diversity, says even if the commission decides to protect the tree, the issue won't be settled for years.
Various business interests will undoubtedly sue, trying to overturn that protection. And conversely, if the commission votes against protecting Joshua trees, I will sue, attempting to overturn that unlawful, unscientific decision.
In June, the California Department of Fish and Wildlife recommended the commission reject the proposed listing. Right now, the trees enjoy state protection while the case is under consideration. This story was produced with original reporting from Kaylee Wells with KCRW in association with Solutions Journalism Network. For California News Service, I'm Suzanne Potter.
You're listening to the KABU Evening News. Stay tuned after this newscast for an in-depth report on Portland community efforts to purchase and preserve the home of Black Portlander and civil rights activist Beatrice Morrow Kennedy. At 6, it's Radio EcoShock. Then at 7, Exploration with Michio Kaku. Tonight's weather will be cloudy with a low of 45 degrees. Tomorrow's weather will be partly sunny, reaching a high of 63. Today in history, in 2001, the United States passed the Patriot Act into law, following the September 11th attacks and the 2001 anthrax scare. Its goal was to increase national security through increased surveillance and harsher punishments for terrorism crimes. The quote of the day is from Edward Snowden, former NSA contractor who leaked information about global surveillance systems. Snowden said, "Arguing that you don't care about the right to privacy because you have nothing to hide is no different than saying you don't care about free speech because you have nothing to say."
As part of the federal government's efforts to help families during the pandemic, lawmakers have expanded the child tax credit to include direct monthly payments for each child under the age of 17. But when the program ended, millions of children fell back into poverty, and advocates say Congress needs to reinstate those payments. Mark Richardson is in Utah and reports on the push to restore the program.
When families began receiving expanded child tax credit payments during the pandemic, the extra family income lifted almost 4 million children out of poverty. But when the payments stopped, child poverty increased by more than 40%. In Utah, just a year after the monthly payment stopped, the number of families with children reporting food insecurity increased by 74%. Gina Cornea with the group Utahns Against Hunger thinks lawmakers should reinstate the $300 to $360 per child payments, especially with inflation near double digits.
With the price of food and with the price of gas and all of these other financial pressures these families are feeling, reinstating the monthly child tax credit would really help ease those economic concerns for families.
Congress debated restoring the payments earlier in the current session, but negotiations stalled after conservative lawmakers claimed they contributed to inflation and demanded that work requirements be added to the program. Political observers say it's unlikely the expanded child tax credit will be restored this year. Research shows children living in poverty are more susceptible to disease and poor health. They perform at lower academic levels and experience stress and anxiety more often. Cornea says it's impossible to overestimate the difference some financial breathing room makes in the lives of these families.
I think over the lifetime of raising a child, I mean, that's a huge amount of difference. And especially since it's already been demonstrated that the child tax credit raised families out of poverty, who doesn't want that?
Economists say the average family will pay at least an extra $2,300 this year for food, housing, and other essentials. With a child tax credit, a family with one child under age 6 would have received $3,600 to offset those expenses. I'm Mark Richardson for Utah News Connection.
Completing the college financial aid application, known as FAFSA, increases the odds of receiving money for college, but it can be complicated. The U.S. Department of Education is overhauling the form for the 2023-2024 school year. Nadia Romlagan reports in North Carolina.
Changes to the free application for federal student aid, or FAFSA, next year are expected to simplify the process and shorten the amount of time it takes to complete the form, say financial aid experts in North Carolina. Research from the National Center for Education Statistics shows 88% of high school seniors who filed a FAFSA in 2012 attended college within the next few years, compared to 49% who did not. Assistant Director of Financial Aid at William Peace University, Marissa Jones, says the Department of Education is also removing questions related to military selective service and drug convictions.
The important thing for students to keep in mind is when they're ask those questions, they would need to answer them just because the application won't be submitted without it, but the Department of Education removed those rules being a requirement.
One-third of North Carolina undergraduates receive federal student loans, according to the Education Data Initiative. The state spends around $390 million each year on financial aid. To begin the FAFSA process or learn more, the website is studentaid.gov. Catherine Marker with the North Carolina State Education Assistance Authority explains next year's FAFSA will be significantly pared down.
The number of questions is going to be reduced from 108 to about 36. More of the questions will be aligned with federal income tax returns, which simplifies the data that families and students have to apply.
Jones emphasizes the FAFSA is the first step toward unlocking financial aid.
It takes about half an hour if you have all your documents in front of you. That seems like a fair deal to me to spend half an hour on an application and potentially get a chunk of money to help pay for college.
According to the National College Attainment Network, nearly $4 billion in Pell Grants distributed to low-income students who have completed the FAFSA went unclaimed in 2021. This is Nadia Ramlagan for North Carolina News Service.
Candidates in South Dakota are answering questions about reconciliation with Native groups while on the campaign trail ahead of the November election. With that story and more, it's Antonia Gonzalez with National Native News.
This is National Native News. I'm Antonia Gonzalez. There's a long road ahead regarding reconciliation between South Dakota's government and the state's tribes. This could play a factor in the coming election. South Dakota Public Broadcasting C.J. Keene has more.
While attending a recent Sioux Falls Rotary Club meeting, South Dakota Democratic gubernatorial candidate Jamie Smith was faced with a question about reconciliation with the state's tribes.
We keep working towards it, but I think it's something that's probably never done, but the focus has to remain. The people that were here first shouldn't be treated last. So I have a friend named Ed Ironcloud. Some of you might know Ed from Pine Ridge. He came in. He's a real quiet man. He comes and sits in my office and kind of rocks. I said, Jamie, we got to figure out how to make Native Americans be part of the fabric of South Dakota again, instead of just being kind of over here.
Incumbent Republican Governor Kristi Noem has vocalized desires to improve state-tribal relations, but she's faced pushback on issues like tribal sovereignty over COVID-19 restrictions, as well as her so-called riot-boosting act, which some tribal members saw as an effort to limit their right to protest. Representatives from Noem's campaign pointed to Chapter 18 of her book, Not My First Rodeo, in which Noem says her guiding principle on tribal issues has been to, quote, let me try. Smith described Noem's administrative policy surrounding Native issues as, quote, combative.
COVID was part of that. But I think we have to respect their sovereignty and making a different choice for their people. And then when it comes to how do you work together through our issues, it can't be us as a state going to the tribe and saying, this is what you have to do.
Oglala Sioux Tribe President Kevin Killer says reconciliation plays a part in every facet of government.
We need to look at all things that the state of South Dakota is involved in, especially around economic development and how to open up those doors. And I know that the governor has Go ED program around economic development, and they have influence over how that's administered. Things like that would go a long way.
Killer also cited health care and law enforcement as issues he'd be interested in collaborating with state government on. For National Native News in Rapid City, I'm CJ Keene.
The Association of Tribal Archives, Libraries, and Museums Conference is underway in Temecula, California. One of the focuses is how to help tribal and non-tribal cultural institutions work together, as Rhonda Lavaldo reports.
In a presentation, representatives from federal repositories showed attendees how to search their collections online. Barbara Baer, historian and curator with the Library of Congress, explains the importance of doing the training.
We want to have a two-way relationship and also to consult with them to improve the way we do things and to gain knowledge from them that they can help us with descriptions and just things that we experience today of like recognizing a relative in a photograph or something like that, to be able to put a name to that face. It's very important. So we find in sharing a lot of good comes from it.
Amy Mossett, Mandan Hadatsa Arikara, and director of the Tribal Education Department, talked about finding her grandmother's recording done by Frances Densmore in the collections.
I was eventually able to hear my great-great-grandmother singing a Mandan garden song. And my mother had never heard that. My mother has since passed away. But I am just so glad that I was able to share that recording.
The Smithsonian, National Museum of the American Indian, and National Archives also were present and welcomed more people to search their collections, as they are always updating the information they have, as well as contacting them if more guidance is needed. This is Rhonda Lavaldo for National Native News.
And I'm Antonia Gonzalez.
Native American advocates say indigenous people remain disenfranchised in many ways. Leaders of the nation's tribal colleges and universities say boosting higher education within these populations can help reduce barriers. They say one way to help is to show up at the polls. Mike Moen has more on the story.
South Dakota is home to three tribal colleges and universities. Higher education leaders for indigenous populations say they hope to see strong turnout for the midterms, as it could help them elevate the pathways of more students. Cheryl Crazy Bull with the American Indian College Fund says because most of these schools are on reservations, they can't rely on state support, only federal funding. She says they hope to see voters research candidates who would make funding a priority so these schools could have more of a firm financial footing.
We need people in Congress who support Native higher education so that we can get the kinds of resources that we need.
She says additional support could also help address gaps in Native students seeking financial aid. During the pandemic, Congress has provided emergency relief to tribal colleges, but leaders testified before federal lawmakers that their funding levels per student remain inadequate, typically falling below the authorized level of $9,000. In neighboring Minnesota, Jacob MacArthur leads economic development for the White Earth Tribal Government. He attended his area's community college before moving on to a mainstream university. He says tribal schools, or TCUs, serve as a great bridge, especially for non-traditional students, whether they finish at another school or fill needed roles within their community.
Our TCUs are really important for workforce development. It isn't just about the two-year degree and putting you on the path towards that four-year degree.
According to the Gallup-Purdue Index, nearly 75% of tribal college alumni said they were employed in areas related to American Indian communities or tribal lands, and many worked directly with their tribe. Mike Moen, Greater Dakota News Service.
The rain is back, and KBOO News poet Dan Raphael is bundling up.
Rain and cold are here. Clock change will accelerate darkness as we ride the election's aftershocks. Knowing whoever wins this time, the prices of bread, gas, and housing won't be going down. At least most of us have held on to our jobs longer than Prime Minister Liz Truss. And how about them Blazers, Thorns, Merritt Paulson, please go away. Beavers, Ducks, Seahawks are gladiators of distraction. As the number of channels our ecology can offer are rapidly declining, increasingly depressing, something's gotta give, someone's already taking. When the only news is the weather, things could be worse. So much still simmering. Russia, white American fear and anger, winter with less fuel and food. I won't need a big meal for Thanksgiving. I'll be grateful that disaster hasn't struck yet. For Poetic Justice, this is Dan Raphael.
You're listening to the KBOO Evening News for Wednesday, October 26th, 2022. This is a volunteer-produced newscast, and we encourage your participation. Call or text us with your breaking news, stories, and tips at 971-245-2158. Our remote production team for tonight's newscast includes Dan Raphael and Eric Leuschner. The producer is Althea Billings, and our engineer is Ray Bodwell. Special thanks to Nadia Ramlagan, Alex Gonzalez, Suzanne Potter, Mike Moen, Antonia Gonzalez, and Dr. Anthony Leisowitz. The director of the Evening News is Althea Billings. A podcast of this newscast is available on our website at kboo.fm/eveningnews. You are listening to KBOO Portland on 90.7 FM, K282BH Philomath on 104.3 FM, and K220HR Hood River on 91.9 FM. I'm Josh Salem.
And I'm Michelle Coppola. All of our KBOO programs, including the Evening News, are supported by our members. That would be awesome folks like you. If you'd like to become a member and support your local community radio station, you can go to kboo.fm/give or text KBOO to 44321. Stay tuned now for KBOO News in Depth. Have a great night. We'll be right back.
KBOO News In Depth, where we take a deeper look at the top news stories impacting our community.
Beatrice Morrow Kennedy was the first Black woman to graduate law school in Oregon, and she was the founder and editor of the first Black newspaper in Portland, The Advocate. That was in 1903. By 1912, she had purchased a home in Portland under Oregon's Black exclusion laws. She's a seriously influential figure and activist in the history of Oregon. Now, her house is up for sale, and members of Portland's Black community are coming together to purchase and preserve this historic Black Portlander's home. The Abioto family is known for their multidisciplinary work as Black women artists, and Intizar Abioto is leading the effort to purchase the home. Here's Intizar speaking about this from a press conference on October 18th.
We're here today about the Beatrice Morrow Kennedy House. I was invited to take photos of this house for a document that was being submitted to the National Historic Register. It was a document that expounded upon the history of this place to give context and to give the argument that so many of these places that they deserve preservation, that they deserve acknowledgement, that they deserve care.